Now, for regular listeners, you'll be familiar with our next guest. I'm really looking forward to chatting with him for the first time, Eric Crampton. He's the Chief Economist at the New Zealand Initiative. And tonight's topic affects, well, thousands and thousands of people around the country. We're talking heritage buildings. Good evening to you, Eric.
Good evening.
Now, it's a pretty large issue. Where on earth are we going to start on this?
Well, I guess we could start with some of the problems that we're seeing, right? So I think that they illustrate some deeper issues, and those themselves illustrate a broader issue in government's choice between regulation and spending to achieve objectives. But if we just kind of start from the headlines of where we've been, last week here in Wellington, we had a fair number of cases coming through. We saw that the railway station here, which is a heritage-listed building and tries to also manage to be a public transport facility, fair number of people do come into town by train. We don't have the electronic ticketing system that you guys get to enjoy in Auckland. Instead, we've got a heritage ticketing system to go along with the heritage railway station. So you either have cash with you on the train and you pay the conductor cash and they give you a bit of change, or you've bought a little paper ticket that they'll clip to show that it's been used, or you buy a 10 clip, which is also a little cardboard ticket, and they'll clip it each time you use it, or you can buy a monthly pass.
Now, I've got to stop you. Why do they not have? Is it because you can't install an electronic machine because it's a heritage building?
Well, there's been a lot of problems, but the most recent one that came up is the fights that they've been having with Heritage New Zealand over whether you can put the little electronic kiosks and turnstile things for checking people's electronic cards as part of a trial to see whether the new system that they'd like to run is working. So we do have electronic ticketing on our buses. The Snapper network works very well. You just wave your card at the thing when you're going onto the bus and it all charges to your account. They wanted to roll that out on the trains as well, but they wanted to have some of these little charge points as you go through the station. There are going to be 6 of them, I understand. And the railway station, which wants to be a functioning public transport facility, wanted them to be in fairly obvious colors so that people would know where to go to wand in. But they've been having months and months of correspondence with Heritage New Zealand on this. And a Kapiti Coast district councillor was getting annoyed by this because he does commute that way, and got by OIA 128 pages of correspondence between the Greater Wellington Regional Council and Heritage New Zealand and Wellington Council and Kiwi Rail on just how and whether they'd be able to set up these just the little pillars that would let people wand through. So Heritage New Zealand thought that the colors were wrong. They wanted to have it in kind of the more traditional brown shades. Then after that came out, I guess there was a bit more appetite for news on these problems. We saw that the heritage restrictions were actually blocking the installation of a wheelchair accessibility ramp for the train station. So we've got heritage steps because heritage people never had disabilities and we didn't have ramps for dealing with that. But now, of course, we would like to make those accommodations. And it's pretty difficult for those who have mobility issues to navigate that at the Wellington train station. Unfortunately, a ramp was not consistent with how Heritage New Zealand was viewing this. There is some argument back and forth about who's responsible for it, whose fault it was that things weren't progressing. There's some news reported on that today. But it goes back further, right? So there's this particular building, which is a Category 1 heritage-listed building. Mm-hmm. If we step back about a month, Wellington was considering the long-term sort of spatial plan for the city. They want to enable more housing. We have a desperate housing shortage here. We're starting to hit sort of Auckland-looking levels of house prices. We've got these substantial shortages. And there's just a lot of places where you're not allowed to build or change anything in Wellington because they are designated as character precincts or heritage precincts. So there's a lot of restrictions then on changing the housing there. You'll have some heritage-listed buildings particularly, like the railway station or a few others. There's something like there's over 600 of these that are listed on Wellington Council's page. So these would be Wellington Council protected ones. There's also then the Heritage New Zealand ones on top of that. But the effect of this is to make it a lot harder to change land use. The best understanding that we've come to on how some of these were designated in the first place, we'd done a little bit of work on this with Deloitte in 2016, because in moving to Wellington from Christchurch, just walking by buildings that looked like the buildings that fell over in Christchurch and killed people, and they were still here in Wellington, scared the heck out of me. So I wanted to do a bit of work looking at what was preventing strength, getting some of these buildings up to spec. So it is looking through the heritage regs. It's ossified a lot of that. Now Wellington's a bit ahead of the game compared to where Christchurch was, but there's still substantial impediments. The fights that we had at the district council hearings had heritage advocates on one side emphasizing the importance of heritage buildings and the kinds of community that they create and the overall feel of a place, against those who recognize the costs that we get out of this kind of encumbrance on a town. So cities have to be able to move, to live and change, right? They're not static.
Eric, can I just question that I've got, you know, surely, I mean, this happens overseas. You look at all those amazing historic buildings overseas who are able to incorporate new technology. This seems crazy that, we could be this, you know, an issue like the, you know, the Wellington railway station could be take up how many pages of material and so much, you know, hours or months of taxpayers' money, really, isn't it? You know, debating these issues. Surely there's a practical solution.
Well, the solution that I've ended up coming to on this, I think it makes more sense in the case of heritage preservation to try and place the cost of it where the benefits are really accruing rather than on the owners of the buildings that are providing the heritage amenity for the broader public. So when you go around town, or at least for me, I enjoy seeing some of these buildings. It makes me happy.
Absolutely.
Not all of the benefit of that goes to the owner of the building in rents. There's some case for public subsidy for some of this, and we do have a bit of it. So there's the Heritage Equip grants that came through under the last government that started facilitating a bit of strengthening on some of the heritage buildings that are earthquake prone. Very small relative to the scale of the problem. There are just so many heritage churches in small towns that have congregations that cannot afford to bring them up to spec. These kinds of grants can help a little bit, but the problem is much bigger than that. When the heritage encumbrances are placed on top of earthquake strengthening, you can easily magnify the cost of doing the strengthening works. When we were looking at Christchurch with the earthquakes, there was a former church there, the Trinity Church, that had turned into a restaurant. The owners of it had wanted to strengthen the steeple back in the 1980s. The 80s and 90s, they were trying to get the strengthening work done in case there was ever an earthquake. Because it's a heritage-listed building and because the strengthening solution was likely to damage one shutter on it, they just couldn't do it. And then the building got wrecked when the earthquakes finally happened. We're trying to preserve heritage amenities by loading the owners of heritage buildings, often who are people who love the heritage buildings, right? They bought those buildings for a reason. Sometimes they prefer to bowl them because they actually aren't serving the purpose. But it's often the heritage aficionados who own these buildings and are saddled with these costs. And it's the rest of us that get to enjoy the benefits of it.
Enjoy them, that's right. Yeah, of course. And you look at San Francisco and Sydney and Paris, you know, so many areas of character and not so much tourism now, but certainly they attract people, they attract tourists to the area. So why should the burden be on the owners? It should be a more, You would think possibly it should be the onus should be on governments or local bodies to help preserve. So I'm with you on this.
I think it should be a mix between central government and local government as well as crowdfunding, because a lot of people care about some people care about heritage a lot, some people not very much. Crowdfunding can assist with this. You can make private contributions to some of the trusts that help preserve heritage buildings. But I think it illustrates what this broader problem that we have, that some problems are best solved through regulation. Some are best solved through government spending measures. But when governments face a budget constraint, they will have a bias towards imposing the costs on private property owners rather than on the tax base more broadly, because, well, when you have a budget process, you've got ministers and ministries that are fighting for attention, for fighting for budget bids. If one thing gets funded, something else doesn't. If we just shunt the cost over onto private landowners or private building owners, well, that's kind of problem solved as far as government can be concerned sometimes. But that can compound into larger problems. It's making heritage strengthening works a lot more difficult here, because you have to do things in ways that are consistent with the heritage regs. If you flip the system so that if your strengthening works actually were to the detriment of the heritage amenity provided, your subsidy would reduce. you get paid less for what you're providing. But the other really nice thing that happens is when you're facing this kind of a budget constraint, you face harder decisions about priorities. So right now, it's relatively cheap and easy for the officials to just impose costs infinitely on building owners. Mm-hmm. So if something has fairly limited heritage value, but would add enormously to the cost facing a building owner for strengthening, well, they don't really have to worry about that as much. The building owner is stuck with it. So there's one on Adelaide Road right now, a hotel where the owner insists that the cost of the strengthening works would be higher than the value of the building after it was strengthened, and he doesn't want to do it. But he's compelled to because if an earthquake hits, it's going to fall over and kill people. So we have regulations preventing that. Unfortunately, the cost of meeting that while also meeting the heritage regulations is almost impossible. The owner would probably be better off bowling that building because it's of dubious character. And there's a lot of other things that the city could be doing in that spot. It could be suitable for a lot more housing or for other mixed-use development. We've been trying to... I think back to the Lego movie when President Business was gluing the whole town down with the craggle and stopping anything from ever changing because it was just the way that he wanted it. And he got mad when anybody tried to change anything. And too much of our consenting processes, and especially once it comes in around heritage, have been like that. Instead of letting cities be living things, right? We've got people live their lives here. We move around all the time, and the cities have to be able to move and adjust as these circumstances change. But the problem goes beyond heritage when we're thinking about the regulation versus spending kind of trade-off the governments would face. If we're looking, take something entirely different from heritage. We've seen strong protests against some of the government's environmental measures in protecting wetlands. So wetlands are really important. They provide a really important freshwater cleansing amenity, biodiversity benefits. The benefits of that aren't just to the property owner. The property owner is already incorporating those benefits that he or she's already enjoying in making decisions about land use. It's the broader community that enjoys these broader benefits, and trying to put all of the costs of that onto the existing property owners, it does poorly by existing property rights. It imposes additional costs on folks who might not be able to bear it. It means that they're going to want to try and avoid the imposition. And if you flip the system again from regulating to mandate that certain things be undertaken or preventing people from changing land use when it makes sense to instead paying them for the public benefit that's being provided by the things that they're doing, you would encourage them to be, acting in the public interest, right? You're aligning then self-interest with public interest. Otherwise, you just wind up in sort of pernicious situations. So, again, if we're thinking about environmental regulation, and I used to teach on this at Canterbury University, there's some nice little case studies out the United States and the Endangered Species Act, where the threat of a species being listed would often induce property owners to go in with chainsaws and destroy the habitat before anybody noticed that they had it, because if they were known to have habitat for a species that was going to be listed as endangered, they were forever forbidden from changing that land use. And that was just a massive regulatory taking, right? But there's a public benefit. We could instead be paying people to maintain the habitat that provides these services instead of imposing the cost on the private property owners. It would force a little bit of harder thinking about the real benefits that are provided and how they stack up compared to other things that the government might want to spend money on that are also good, healthcare, policing, everything else. But it would force that more explicit weighing up of the trade-offs, where it's too easy to avoid that by just shunting the whole cost over onto the private sector.
Yeah. Oh, look, this is a fairly gnarly issue, and I think we could talk about it for a really long time, take up the whole hour, but we have run out of time. Eric, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. We're getting lots of feedback, in which I'll cross to later. But thank you very much, Eric Crampton, Chief Economist at the New Zealand Initiative. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you.